Hello, it's Yotam here. Thank you for continuing to listen to Simple Pleasures. And for anyone new here, I hope you enjoy the series. I wanted to let you know that I have a new cookbook out this September, co-written with Easter Belfridge, who works with me in my test kitchen. It's called Ottolenghi Flavor and is available to order now. Flavor is a vegetable-scented cookbook which focuses on all the different ways in which you can dial up flavor and create fireworks in your cooking, true to the Ottolenghi spirit. Hello and welcome to Simple Pleasures with me, Yotam Ottolenghi. This is a series in which I invite you and a special guest to my home to discuss the simple pleasures in life. From food, mainly food actually, to travel, to art, to food again. We discuss all of this over dishes from my new cookbook, Ottolenghi Simple. To me, simple means ease. It means less anxiety and less stress, doing things that are comfortable and familiar and not always massively challenging. I want to take the guilt out of the equation and inject an extra dose of joy. Today I've got Helen Goh. She's a really, really close friend. I've known her for more than a decade. She's everything. She's a cook, chef, recipe developer. She works with me. We published a book together called Sweet. She's also got a PhD in psychology, so she's like a superwoman. And Helen and I will talk a bit. I'll serve her chili fish with tahini. She's from Malaysia, so she loves chili. And I'm going to serve it with some chopped salad with feta and za'atar. And we'll just kind of hang out, talk about life's simple pleasures, and have a good time. Yeah, I just decided to dress up for the occasion.
Very nice.
The theme is simple pleasures. Mm-hmm. And so I made something that I think you like, which is a chili fish.
Mm. So
there's a chili theme going on in our lives,
chili.
Right?
You had me at chili.
I knew it. So there's chili fish, and then there's a kind of a Middle East. I thought I couldn't cook Asian food for you because you introduced me to Asian food. But so I'm making like a Middle Eastern kind of version of what would be quite popular in Malaysia, where you grew up. So
okay.
A chili fish, great. I think it would be popular. But so a chili fish and a kind of a chopped Arabic Israeli salad. The thing is, so I'm trying to figure out, not really scientifically, but just through kind of chatting to you and to other people, people's idea of simple pleasure. What does simplicity mean for you? And what's simple pleasure? Because the book is really all about looking at, from this perspective, at food. So what could we do to make your life easier, right?
So what would make your life easier?
Oh, I was going to ask you that question.
Yes.
Well, for me, I think really it's about, first of all, not feeling that I've got to perform. For me, the ideal scenario for simple cooking is 8 o'clock in the evening, Carl's gone upstairs to watch some TV, and I'm here making a cake for people who are coming the next morning and the ingredients for a frittata or something like that. You know, kind of getting all the usual business of the day out of the way.
So and having engaging that space and time at night.
Yes. Space and time. It doesn't need to be at night. Would you like a pistachio?
Yes, please. Just one or ten. When everything else is dealt with, then you can focus on the cooking.
Yeah, because there's so much going on in my life.
Yeah.
And as I know it's you, I mean, I better mention to the audience who you are and what you are and what our relationship is.
Sure.
So Helen and I have met about 10 years ago when she came over from Australia, right? You came over from Australia to move to London, and you were a pastry chef and a psychotherapist. You still are, all of the above.
Yeah.
And you asked me for a job. And to make a very short story, we worked together for many years. And you worked at Ottolenghi, and you create, and you still create recipes for Ottolenghi. And then last year we published a cookbook together called Sweet. And we became friends, and you taught me about Asian food.
We
traveled to Asia. We traveled to Malaysia together.
Malaysia.
We always used to say Malaysia, truly Asia.
Truly Asia. Malaysia, truly Asia.
Which
yeah.
was a slogan experience. For the Malaysian tourist board, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, and now I've just brought you here, first of all, to feed you, but then, to kind of understand what it is that makes. I see it not so much about cooking, simple cooking or easy cooking, but about a state of mind.
That's an interesting way of putting it.
Yeah. Recently, I've written something. I said it's not about easy. It's about ease. And
how would you differentiate the two?
I've been in a situation where I had to cook the simplest dish, just like fried fish. Mm-hmm. With the salsa, and it was just went so wrong. I had a camera in front of my eyes, so I had to do it for a program I did for Channel 4 years ago, and I was filming in Morocco, and I had an audience. So I said, it's fine, you have an audience, it's fine, but they were all like strangers, you know, a few kids that gathered around. It was cooking outdoors in a restaurant, and so we were on the beach.
Yeah.
And the wind was just blowing really hard, so the coals were just like completely either blown out completely, or I had this gunk going all over the fish.
Yeah.
And I was just super stressed, and I just couldn't get it right until they kind of put the board or something to stop the wind, and it was just like.
Yeah.
And then a few days later, I went with these fishermen on their boat, and they were cooking something really elaborate with hardly anything. You know, they caught some sardines, minced them up with this like. Machine that like a tiny food processor that they had a little battery that they attached to make, and they make the most delicious fish cakes in a tomato sauce, and they did it and they did it in like 20 minutes in the worst conditions, and it was a complicated recipe. They were filleting the sardines by hand, they were getting all this some of the bones out, they were blitzing it, they were making a tomato sauce, everything.
And did you think it looked easy?
No, what I'm saying is it was easy for them.
Oh, right.
I mean,
yes.
It was easy for them. They
were
on a boat.
Yeah.
They were cooking something quite complicated.
They're also used to those conditions. I mean, you're not used to having wind gale forces blow at you while you're cooking in the kitchen.
I'm not. No, I'm not.
But I think simple is I mean, for example, with cakes anyway.
Yeah.
They're the hardest to get right, I think.
Simple recipes.
Simple cakes, anyway.
Really? What
don't you think? Like, if you want to do like a very simple Victoria sponge, you know, it's got to be perfect.
Because you're so exposed.
Because you're
there's
so
exposed. No...
Because the cake is so exposed. There's nothing.
That's what
you know,
I mean.
No big ganache and no big salted caramel praline
you're
on
just,
earth, you know.
You're just judged by the quality of
the
sponge.
The quality of the sponge, the crumb, the flavor.
This is what I was thinking about the cake that they did recently for the royal wedding.
Ah, yeah.
Claire Pack's cake.
Yes.
And I was thinking, it wasn't one of these traditionally elaborate, massive cakes that they used to have for royal weddings, right? In the couple of
No, not at all. In fact, it relied very much on... I mean, even the icing, the finish, was deliberately unfinished, you know? Because some people said, oh, God, it doesn't look like it would smell better. No, that's the style.
Yeah,
and
I
thought, I loved it.
I thought it was beautiful.
Beautiful.
As opposed to these kind of marzipan-laden fruitcakes with all the icing that takes a week to make. And you go like, who wants to eat that?
Exactly. I mean, I think they really made a thing of, you know, that the elderflower picked at... Prince Charles's estate, and you know, and the flowers were also picked. Well, maybe some of them, maybe not.
So that's also another example, really, where simplicity can really get you amazing results.
Yeah,
you know,
beautiful. It was
you
beautiful.
Get, we often say that you know, you could do one thing really well.
Yeah,
it's worth than a million other things
absolutely.
That are kind of not
absolutely
really 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 well.
Yeah. So what are you cooking that's super simple? Because it doesn't look that simple to me.
That is really simple.
This is
from the book Simple.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And essentially what it is simple. It really is simple.
Yeah.
So I've got here chopped...
Because I'm distracting you.
You are
talking.
I can't talk. I have a nibble here. Let's just start with a nibble. So those are butter beans.
They're huge. Yeah. I thought they actually were nice little plump garlic.
Oh, really? No, they're butter beans. And they're... marinated in chili oil,
cascabel
oil, the Mexican chili, with some lime, and then they get another extra squeeze.
Delicious! I'm going to have another one
of citrus on top. And the fish that I'm cooking is halibut, quickly cooking in a sauce that is. It is simple, really simple.
It's almost like it's poached in there. Is it poaching?
So essentially it's a tomato-based sauce. Mm-hmm. So they've got chilies, garlic, tomatoes, so you've got fresh chilies and ancho chilies. And then it's what I do is I just drizzle it with a bit of tahini sauce.
Oh,
so tahini is another, quite predictably, tahini is another theme, you know.
Well, that adds a lot of flavor just with the one product, doesn't it?
Yeah. Completely. Yeah. But let's go back to what I was going to ask you, and then you asked me.
Yeah.
What is for you, not simple, but easy cooking?
Easy cooking.
Yeah.
You know, I think when I had the kids,
yeah,
the thing that really came into its own is the freezer for me.
The freezer?
Yeah.
I love my freezer.
You know, I even, in fact, my brother-in-law, who's...
I'll open my freezer door. Well, we both Carl and I cook for the freezer, and I think this thing, this drawer...
Salt beef in the freezer. Wow, I
made
that.
Some salt beef the other day.
That's great.
But just that drawer is just, it gives you confidence.
Doesn't it? Right.
You can come home from work, exactly. And you know there's something there that you could...
Yeah. It makes such a difference. And I used to think it was too much of a shortcut, as though it was like a sacrifice in quality or something if you freeze. So then I did it by necessity because of the kids, and I realized actually it's fantastic.
So what is the easiest? Cooking in batch cooking on the weekend to put in containers for the week?
Yeah, and I know you and I freeze crepes, right?
You told me to freeze crepes and I follow you.
Well, although I did take it one step too far last week when I froze like 50 of them without putting the parchment paper between them. And oh my goodness, after it was like trying to... I was tearing them apart trying to separate them. They all stuck.
Terrible.
My brother-in-law, Josh, who's a pediatric nephrologist, which is someone who specializes in kidney problems in babies and infants, he came over to do a stint at the Great Ormond Street Hospital.
Uh-huh.
But when he went back to Melbourne, he said the best thing he learned when he came to stay in London was that how to freeze cooked rice. How cooked rice made his life so much easier.
So do you freeze cooked rice?
I do.
Sorry to go down to that level of details, but
no, I do, and it's great.
So
it takes at least 20 minutes to cook, and it's not without... I mean, I know people laugh and think that I must just cook rice with my eyes closed because I'm Chinese, but actually it took me a long time to learn how to get rice to the kind of texture that I like.
Really?
I think it's because growing up, we cut big family, 5 kids. My mother always used a huge rice cooker. So I never saw it being made, really. I think it's a security thing, where as long as there's kind of rice bubbling away in there in a pot, hot, you know, warm, ready to go, you feel kind of safe and secure. That's like the backdrop of Asian cooking, you know?
I never thought about it like that.
Well, you know the Chinese greeting, you know, they don't say, hi, how are you? They say, hi, japabe, which is, hi, have you eaten? And it's actually, if you translate it literally, it means, have you eaten rice? Because surely you can't be well if you haven't eaten rice.
Wow.
So that is the greeting.
So we should find the equivalent.
We need to. Have you had tahini?
Or maybe something like, what's cooking good looking?
Might be your television show or something.
So I'm just going to finish the salad. So as you expect, there's lots of lemon juice and olive oil and za'atar on top. Oh. But it really is like something that we've seen a million times, but you can never get enough of. I guess it's a bit like your rice, you know, a chopped salad. I mean, in Israel, where I grew up, a chopped salad is something you have for every meal. Yeah. So
you know, when I was in Israel, in Tel Aviv, we had that for breakfast, and I loved it.
Yeah.
And then I thought, I'm going to come back and eat this every morning, and I've never done it. Although, we did talk about putting it on the menu.
After we went to Malaysia, I thought I'm going to make nasi lemak for every breakfast, and I haven't made nasi lemak since,
If only you could, I would be here every morning.
So
that's your tahini.
So I've got the chopped vegetables, tomatoes, cucumbers, and peppers, some za'atar on top, and I'm just going to drizzle a bit of raw tahini.
Can I take some?
Let's go
to
the table. Yeah, you can take a monk's beard.
So you were asking me about this simple, you know, what other things sort of ease my life.
Yeah, tell me.
I mean, I think one of the things I like doing is just buying what is good and augmenting it with what I'm making. So I can just focus on what I love making.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if I want to make a sponge cake, I might buy a really good lemon curd.
Mm.
You know, so I think that makes life easy.
Really simple.
So you can then just focus on what you enjoy doing, rather than thinking you've got to make all these components.
So essentially what you're saying is that there's no shame in using something that's been made or prepared.
Absolutely not.
Or...
Because the thing is, I mean, in desserts anyway, or actually not just in desserts, but there's so many components to a dish. So for example, like if you wanted to make a dish poached in tomato, you could buy the tomato sauce, right? Yeah. Good quality passata, yeah. Right?
Completely.
And then you could enjoy the process rather than thinking, oh God, I've got to make the sauce. Then you've lost the will to live by the time you...
I completely agree with that. Like, I love certain things that come out of cans, like, you know, like sardines or anchovies, really good ones. So often I think, oh, what should I do with this tin of Ortiz anchovies, you know, because they're so nice.
Yes.
And my parents, they're both great cooks, and my dad has an Italian heritage, and they have absolutely no qualms about opening one of these Barilla jars, you know, of sauce.
Yeah, exactly.
Or any other brand, you know, there's many of them, and just adding a bit of basil. And so someone made the tomato sauce, like you said, but I'm just going to augment it or fix it a bit.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
But what do you cook when you want to entertain? Because you entertain a lot, right?
I used to. I mean, not so much.
BC, now. Before children.
Before children, exactly. What do I? I mean, I feel most comfortable probably with Asian cooking.
Mm-hmm.
But I quite like things that you can prep ahead of time, obviously. I'm working, for example, on a breakfast strata at the moment. You know, like a savory bread pudding.
Oh,
like
thing. Oh, yeah.
And I'm thinking, why don't I do this more often? I'm doing it for the column that I write for, but...
You have a column for Australia newspaper.
Newspaper, yeah. And, I mean, you sauté off, you know, chorizo or whatever you want to put in it. But then you layer it or toss it with the bread, pour the custard over, and you leave it in the fridge overnight. And then in the morning, you just pop it in the oven.
I love bread puddings.
Yeah. Well, I didn't really... I'm actually doing it for Father's Day in Australia. Mm-hmm. But I had not made one before. And now I'm thinking I'm going to make one every Sunday.
Helen, how do you eat on a podcast?
Yeah, well, I've got my thought poise. I'm thinking, when can I eat?
Eat something.
Because you can edit out all the noises of pleasure.
If you don't make noises of pleasure, then it's not a food podcast, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Mm.
So I'll ask you another thing.
Yeah.
Because you traveled from one culture to another. You know, you moved from Melbourne to London more than a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about, it's a big question, but it's about food and identity. Like, I perceive you as two things, as Australian and Malaysian, I guess almost in equal measures.
Yeah.
Food is definitely part of your identity, because as soon as I've met you, you cooked a Malaysian meal or Malaysian food for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, but do you feel that is really part of your DNA, this particular food that you grew up having, Australia, Malaysia?
You know what? I think it is, but I think it probably is more so because it's Malaysia. David, my husband, very uncharitably says that Malaysians have no other culture. That's why they rely on food. Food is their culture. And I get really irritated when I hear that, because it's so dismissive. But I think there's a bit of truth in it too. Because, yes, I think maybe the food that you... I mean, people say it's almost like a cliche that the food, you know, you'll never forget your mother cooking you this or that. But I think with Malaysian cooking, I mean, Malaysians take their food very, very seriously. And I think it does define you somewhat. I don't know that I've ever met a Malaysian who didn't like to eat.
Or to cook?
Well, no, actually, Malaysian cooking is quite complex.
Malaysian cooking really does rely on a lot of shortcuts. So you take something like ketchup manis, which is something that has been prepared and made, and it's part of the preparation process, right? Is that true or not?
Yes,
really?
Yes and no, but then you've got the sambals. Now, any good home cook would not buy a sambal. They would make their sambal, which goes from sort of rehydrating dry chilies and pounding it with like a mortar and pestle.
But it's not realistic in our day and age.
It's like, not. That's why few people cook Malaysians, even Malaysians. And also you'll see, I mean, you know, we went to Malaysia together.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see that there are street stalls all day long. I mean, in the morning you have the kuih, which is those steamed glutinous rice cakes.
Oh,
you have noodles, nasi lemak, roti canai. You have all of that. And then it's no sooner it's packed away that the kind of elevenses comes out, and they will be anything from goreng pisang, which is sort of banana fritters, to a bowl of, you know, red bean soup, which is sweet, you know, or ice kacang. You know,
my dread.
Your dread. My heaven.
I never get my head around something that's got
but ice. Did you not like ice cones when you were growing up?
Corn and syrup, and I go like, oh my gosh, how could you eat that?
I know.
But I know it's a kind of a childish thing. I don't yeah. like the. Gary loves that. What's it called? The bubble tea.
Oh yeah, I can't stand the bubble tea.
So
I actually even have a bit of a phobia about that bubble tea.
Yeah, not another phobia.
One of my many. But that one is about kind of feeling it choking me, those bubbles.
Really?
It doesn't feel like it's organic, that material. It feels like it's synthetic.
Completely. You're eating plastic.
Yeah. Actually, plastic recently egg. A friend of mine took Sam, my son, out for a movie and they had bubble tea afterwards and I was so irrationally furious with
really?
Her. Really? Yeah, because I was like, do not introduce him to that. I'll never take him to a bubble tea shop. He loved it, of course.
Mm. But you know that Malaysian way of eating, which is complex, and there's expectation for a certain bit to be served every part of the day, you know, the breakfast, the lunch, the dinner. I think that one of the problems that we have in Western cultures is that we try to import all sorts of ideas about eating from other cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And then we think, oh, we really have to have this and that and that and prepare whole meals. And I've really enjoyed recently Ruby Tando saying, you know, we actually... All these expectations are really can be quite oppressive, you know, because you decide what's right and what's wrong, and you other people tell you don't decide what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah.
People tell you how you should eat, what is expected of you. Everything needs to be super wholesome.
Yeah.
And we import anxieties from other cultures. Well, we import other cultures' values, and then we become anxious about it.
Yeah, and I think not just other cultures, but even within our own culture, we listen to dictates about what we ought to eat, and then you lose that barometer of what you want to eat. I mean, I find sometimes I have a bit of that when I think, okay, well, I can't eat this today or that today. And actually, at the end of the day, I end up eating more because I'm not satisfied. Whereas when I listen to myself and think, okay, you really want chili fish, have your chili fish and then shut up, yeah, you know?
I know why you say chili fish, that's what I mean.
Well, it's just because it's in front of me looking delicious, but it could be anything,
yeah.
You know? I think this idea about eating what you want, isn't that the title of her book, by the way? One of them, anyway. No, Eat Up, which is also nice. I like being told to eat up. you lose the barometer of what you're really craving and what you really want. And
yeah.
I know when... I don't know whether this is a bit romantic, but I know when I eat what I really feel like, I'm satisfied. I don't then pick at things and binge and go and eat, you know, chips and...
I think this is really key because, you know, sitting here with you, eating something that's been literally cooked, could be cooked within half an hour, it's quite liberating that you can actually put a meal on the table within a short amount of time.
Also very satisfying, right? To be able to put it together and also for it to look good, because I think that's half of it, isn't it?
Yeah. So I'm trying to do this thing because of this guilt about, you know, thinking, oh, what should I eat and what should I be feeding my kids and how to do it properly. I tried to do something which is, you know, you reminded me by saying, you know, listening to your inner voice that knows if you're hungry or not hungry, you know what you need, what you don't need. And just come and cook what I feel like and not think what they need to eat now because they haven't had fish for 3 days. I'm going to make fish now.
Yeah,
I'm going
exactly.
to do this, that, or the other. Because I don't think our parents did anything like that. I'm looking back at the way I was raised. I don't think anyone thought about how you need to be really kind of completely on, you know, in party line when it comes to nutrition or the right balance or all that kind of stuff. And then that's what you're talking about. You were talking about losing... The sense
touch
of a compass, you know, having an inner compass telling you what is right and what's wrong. And just cook what you feel like cooking, what you love eating and, you know, and giving desserts and having all those wonderful things.
Yeah.
And I think once you've presented all that, then kids will have a right idea about what's right to eat.
Also just the idea of enjoyment rather than nutrition or balance, you know. I think when there's enjoyment, I really believe that balance takes care of itself.
Absolutely.
Actually, recently, it was Noam, actually, who told me. I don't know how it came up, but he
Noam told me. Noam is one of the partners in Ottolenghi and a good friend, right?
And a really good friend. And I don't know how it came up, but it transpires that Noam and Gary eat the same thing each day of the week. No, we, it came about because we were talking about shopping, and I said I dislike having to shop. And he said,
shop for what?
Shop for food.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Like supermarket shopping, actually. I like going to the market, which we do once a week. But Noam says he has a standing order. When he places an order online, he just presses reorder. Like he orders the same food every week. I said, but how do you do that? That means you're eating the same food every week. He says, yes. On Monday, we have chicken. On Tuesday, we have salmon. And, you know, and he says, it's very simple. And I thought, it does. That is very simple. Because, if I have to place a supermarket order, it takes me ages.
God, you're like me. I mean, it's like even walking into a supermarket is an ordeal because you're never going to come out.
Well, online shopping is no quicker, I can tell you. Because, I have spent 2 hours online shopping. But Noam says he does this. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to do it. It's a great idea. And I tried to do it. I lasted about 4 days, I think. I thought, because you take the compass out of it. You don't have that sense of what you're really craving and what you really want.
So I'll reveal the fact that you're a doctor and you're a psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. So everybody knows now. We got it out of the way, right? Dr. Helen Go.
Oh, God. I don't even know what that means anymore.
So being a psychotherapist and someone who cooks for a living or is surrounded by food for a living, mm-hmm. often people create those kind of... I've been with you and you've been asked, what's the affinity or what are the connections? And you always say, you struggle a bit with the answer to this question.
I know, that's why I'm thinking. You've heard me struggle and you're still asking me this question.
No, but what I was going to say is now I think you actually put the finger on it, because what you said is that, okay, as a psychotherapist, I try to tell people, let people find things from within, I guess. You don't come up with answers as a good psychotherapist.
Thank you. That's very clever. me better than I know me.
And the same is what you said about food. You know, I present a smorgasbord of delicious things to you.
Yeah.
You're my child, my reader, or my client in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And you can choose, but you will know what to choose because there is a bit like there's an inner voice that tells you what's good for you.
Yes, there's that. That's absolutely true, I think. But also, when you eat something that is satisfying and that's something you really want to eat, it hits a spot. And that there's something transformational about that, in the way that if you give a good interpretation to a client or a patient that makes sense to them, it hits a spot.
Yeah.
And that has the capacity to transform. It's very powerful.
Great. Now we know what to answer next time we're asking. You know
so
what to
the
answer,
motto is think carefully what you want to eat and enjoy it.
So just the nitty-gritty of cooking at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. I know we don't need to talk only about that, but do you struggle for ideas what to cook? What am I going to cook today?
No, one of my problems is that I overthink things.
Yes, I know that.
You know what
you
I mean?
Have
and
that
then,
problem.
And if I have people over, I kind of enjoy planning a menu. In fact, I think that's the most enjoyable part.
You
the
used
least,
to be a menu planner, right? Like,
well,
you were catering.
I love that. Yes, exactly. And I had this thing when I was catering that if I couldn't visualize it happening, it wasn't going to be a success. And it was very accurate. The events, let's say it's a wedding party or something, if I couldn't visualize it, maybe it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If I can't visualize it, then I get anxious. And if I get anxious, then I don't do a good job.
So with cooking for your family...
I hate it, to be honest.
You said that.
The everyday, the quotidian cooking, I find it quite tedious. I think that is just about the satisfaction of getting everyone fed and done rather than the enjoyment. I'd like to change, and I am hoping that that will change.
So that is actually really liberating, I think, talking about... simple pleasures or satisfaction.
Yes.
To say, okay, I love cooking. I love food. I don't like cooking for my family on a day-to-day basis. I mean, that is quite... people would find that very liberating to hear that from you.
You mean to acknowledge or to admit?
That it could be a bore. It's not like I don't like food, or it's not like I'm not doing my job properly as a parent, or as it's just can be really boring.
Yeah, I think also that there's a factor of the unpredictability with the kids. So you might think, okay, I'm going to make this, this mee goreng, it's going to be great, we're all going to sit down. And then somehow it doesn't materialize. And it's not their fault. They're just little ones being themselves. But I feel almost like, sit down, I made this for you, sit.
Sit and eat. I got to say, I don't like this. And I don't understand why... on earth would you not like that? Because you liked it yesterday. But that level of consistency is just doesn't apply to children.
But wait a minute, maybe that's a bit hypocritical of us because we can say, well, I like this, but I'm not in the mood for it tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they just...
Yeah, but they're not in the mood for something every day, right?
That's true.
They're not in the mood for this, they're not in the mood for that.
That's
Sometimes
true.
They finish half a bowl and they go, I don't like it.
I also think with Sam particularly, who's very sensitive to all sorts of things, also food and taste buds and all sorts of sensual things. But he used to love papaya, for instance.
Yeah.
And there was a phase where I wasn't getting good papaya, but somehow I didn't think to not feed it to him. And I fed it, and now he hates papaya.
Okay.
So I think, you know, fruit especially, which are just sublime when they're in season and inedible when they're not.
Yeah.
I think that's why, you know, it's not to go on about things being in season, but it's actually that when they taste it, when it's at its peak and they love it, you're building a kind of lifelong enjoyment of food.
I completely agree. We had the same with peaches. So that insistence of having peaches in the winter, and sometimes you succumb and you go and buy one.
Yes, exactly.
And he goes, oh, that was a really bad peach experience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, fruit, I think, is a really good marker of that because it is so different in season.
And it's easy to get them hooked, but it's also easy to get them to hate it.
Because it's kind of like candy, but then, you know, if it's not...
Candy is quite reliable, but fruit...
Candy, well, that's God's candy.
Helen, what else do you do?
Mm-hmm.
We kind of established that you said that food cooking could be quite stressful, but it could also be relaxing when you do your batch cooking. And what else do you find relaxing?
You mean aside from cooking?
Yeah, I'm moving on from food.
Moving on from food.
Is that possible? I can tell that you're quite stressed now.
You know what? I love reading. Probably that's the thing I miss the most, having had the kids, because I just don't have the time to read. I know when I said that to you recently, you said, well, shut up and read. Get reading already.
No, actually, I'm the same. I don't read myself.
I mean? Yeah, and I really miss it. Just that time and that sort of the contemplation and just the beauty of words, you know, good writing, just that. And then absorbing and learning. It's got everything.
Do you think you'll write a novel one day?
No way. I mean, God, writing to me is like... pulling teeth. I would love to write, but I mean, with my column, I only have to write like 5 lines or something, and that's perfect because I do always have something to say about what I'm cooking. But if I have to write like a page, that would take me a month. Like writing my PhD was like
your
torture.
PhD is something that we have all suffered under. Because it took you so long, we had to go through your highs and lows with that
PhD. Yeah, but I never forget what you said to me, which I really took very much to heart, which was when we started writing Sweet, you said to me, now listen, you had your crisis with the PhD, that's over. Now we're going to get to do Sweet and no crisis involved. And I really took that to heart, right? I mean, we had a few tense moments, but generally there were no crises,
no,
right?
No, we didn't really have much crisis.
So I listen to you.
Thank you. No, listen to me now.
Yes, go on. I'll stop eating. I can't stop eating.
I find this eating and podcasting
it's
really
not
complicated.
Easy. Yeah.
Also, I mean, you're not supposed to talk with your mouth full, are you?
Well, I don't mind people talking with their mouth full.
No.
I think that's very natural.
Yeah.
If there's food in front of me, I'm never not eating.
So, not a novel, but what kind of cookery writing do you like? Who inspires you in that department?
I mean, it's probably a cliche because everyone will say it's her, but I do love Nigella's writing,
mm-hmm.
right?
It's okay. We're in a safe space here.
I'm in a safe space, yeah. I mean, it's got everything. It's sort of, you know, she has a kind of judicious amount of self-disclosure about her life.
Yeah.
It's very sensual, I think, but also informative. I mean, I think it's got everything.
Yeah. Recently, I enjoyed Rachel Roddy's writing, both in The Guardian and then her cookbook, and she describes, living in Italy. And I just find these kind of little stories that evoke kind of family and markets and how a kind of a situation turns into a meal or a dish really, really compelling. And I've enjoyed reading that.
Yeah.
But in terms of cookbooks, I know you introduced me to Stephanie Alexander.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And she's great, a great recipe writer, don't you think?
She is, but I think it's more than that. I mean, because she started life as a librarian, adult life anyway. She wasn't born. But the thing about Stephanie Alexander is she makes you feel like, don't take it all so seriously, just cook it. You know, you see her recipes are fairly sparse. There's not a lot of description. In fact, it's almost the opposite of Nigella's, you know. It's very practical, but there's something about it that loosens you up, that makes you think it's all right. And even if you have a soggy bottom, that's fine. You know, it's okay. She'll try and guide you for success. But then there's always built in, there's a caveat almost. It's unwritten, but there's a caveat. It's just enjoy it.
Yeah.
I think that's liberating.
So it's a, we're talking about being liberated from expectations.
We're talking about being liberated a lot. Are we feeling a bit shackled or something?
No, I think that one of the reasons why I was drawn to the question of simple cooking or simplicity in general is because I think there's like these cycles in life where, you know, you start off when you're a bit younger. You know, I feel very middle-aged saying that, with a really high set of expectations. And this set of expectations could be quite frustrating because you never end up being fulfilling your expectations, and you're always kind of feeling like you're running around, you know, can't really catch your tail like a little cat, you know, running in circles, and you never get there. But once you've kind of lowered the expectations in the best possible way, you know, like this meal here, you know, it's something you can
cook. You call this lowering expectations?
I'm only talking about that in the context of, you know, I've been accused over the years of having like 27 ingredients in my recipes, which I raise my hand, I have had those. But, you know, the idea that you cooking is for the weekend, or cooking, or Tolenghi cooking is something that you do when you've got a lot of time.
When you're on holidays.
When you've got someone to wash up your dishes for you.
When you've got a sous chef.
No, all these
sorry,
kind
that's
of things.
True.
Yeah, no,
that's
but these have been, these are kind of accusations that have been leveled at me. And I take the shame, you know. I completely see that many of the recipes do take a lot of time and a special, you know, trip to that shop and that market and you know, and that specialist. And now with this book, what I try to do is to kind of hone on what would make people's life easier in the kitchen. So is it something that you would cook in advance and reheat, or something you'd partly cook and then finish off, or is it something that really has very few ingredients that you could cook quite quickly? So all those kind of questions. And I think it's quite easy to be in a position where you can say to yourself, okay, it's absolutely fine to use, for me it's liberating, 6 ingredients and not 22, you know. It's just and you can get great flavors and you can get great results with not that all that fanfare. And it sounds almost like, you know, like I'm an Ottolenghi heretic, you know, saying, oh, how is that possible? But it is.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah. But what I like about the premise of simple, as you're saying it, is that at different times, simple means different things, you know. So for me, at times, it may be I've got to use up what's in my fridge because I don't have time to go shopping. That's, you know, the simplicity in that sense. And other times, it's the simplicity of being able to prepare it ahead. So if you've got friends coming over, you can just pop it in the oven.
Yeah.
I assume you have those recipes in your book.
I have all of the above. Another thing.
I'll buy it then. I'm going to buy it.
Another thing is that idea that there's a chapter called Easier Than You Think. So, or not a chapter, but a heading. So Easier Than You Think. And I think quite a lot of people are terrified by certain things. You know, when we were doing our sweet tour, people say, oh, I love cooking, but I don't bake because I find it intimidating.
Right.
It's just not my department. I don't do it well. Yeah. And I often think it's psychological. There's nothing about baking which is inherently complicated or difficult. In a sense, it's easier because you only need to follow a recipe. Yeah. And there's very little judgment to exercise along the way if you follow the recipe. So when I was doing this book, I've thought about, okay, well, actually, let's try to introduce someone to ice cream who would never in the world think of making their own ice cream, or pizza, or things that seem chefy or restauranty or just complicated, and say, okay, actually, you could do this within 45 minutes to a good level. And that is liberating.
So what are
it?
Some of the recipes in that category that you think
so your raspberry ice cream recipe?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that easy?
It is easy because it's a no churn ice cream, so that all
that's
already
delicious,
makes
actually.
Quite easy.
That's the one from the Knickerbocker Glory.
Yeah,
oh yeah, I love that.
But just on its own,
and it just tastes so like the raspberries.
It's just
it's
like
beautiful.
Eating the essence of raspberry, right? In cold form. It's just so good.
Yeah.
And in that under that heading, like I said, there is a pizza. Things you bake in general are normally expected to be more complicated than they are.
So is the pizza made from pita bases, or do you make the dough?
You make the dough, but it's a really simple dough that you only let... So you take a bit of instant yeast, a bit of olive oil, flour and a bit of water, and you mix it for a very relatively short amount of time, and you let it rise and it's ready to go. And like I say, people think that there is a lot going on, but actually you could make a pizza within an hour or something that look, you know, resembling a proper pizza.
Because you always think of it like you're doing, it's a special thing if you're doing pizza.
Yeah, you bring everybody around, you get the kids over, you're going to make the dough in the morning, you're going to bake in the afternoon.
But actually, I've made pizza dough. It's not difficult.
It's not.
No.
It's not, but is it not, it's all about myths, isn't it? It's the myth of the pizza and the myth of the ice cream.
Ice cream, yeah.
And so, I mean... I think making your own pasta is not a myth. It's just bloody hard work, right?
Yeah, well, if you have a machine, but even then.
But that actually made me think about something we said before about making pasta, is that cooking with children as opposed to cooking for children. Mm-hmm. You said a few times very bravely on our book tour, it's a nightmare to cook with children because you have this idea that it's going to be fun, but actually it's you never get what you want to achieve because it just becomes a distraction.
Well, I think there are two things going on. You're either cooking with them as an activity, but don't expect that you're going to cook so that you end up with this perfect meal. I think if you can let go of that, it's okay, it's quite enjoyable.
Yeah.
So my thing at the moment when I make cookies, for example, they love cookie dough, is that I make a little bit extra and I give it to them to play with. So it doesn't matter if it's reworked because usually I'm thinking, don't do that again because I need that.
I need that.
And now I just make them their own. They think they're working, you know, sort of baking with me, and they have the sense of baking with me. And I have the sense of baking with them without the anxiety that, oh no, it's going to be all oily and they've got snot on it or something.
Yeah, well, the snot is a problem, isn't it?
The snot would be a problem, yes.
Another thing that I wanted to ask you about is a bit like that it involves traveling and food. So we traveled together in Malaysia and this was one of the most fundamental food experiences that I had, because it doesn't happen very often that I go somewhere and I'm exposed to a cuisine that I really have no idea about, and I enjoy it to that level. Because before we traveled to Malaysia together, we went to a couple of Malaysian restaurants in London, but I had no idea about how immense that cuisine is and how complicated and complex and diversified it is, because it's made out of three cultures. You know, these are the cuisines of three cultures brought together in one nation. And I remember that when we were traveling, you were like almost like an encyclopedia of food. Like you went and you said, oh, you've got to try that. So, you know, the nasi lemak was the first breakfast we had when we arrived in Penang. But then it was, you know, we had all the laksas, all the particular laksas from the different regions, and all the rice dishes and the desserts and everything. And it was, for me, it was just such an eye opener. You know, before we traveled to Malaysia, I couldn't even eat a tofu. You know, I hated tofu. And, you know, people think like, how is that possible? Someone that, you know, published so many tofu recipes.
I see that as one of my greatest achievements, to have converted me to tofu.
Yeah, I know. But when you travel, do you have that kind of, I think you recently went to Sicily.
Yes.
And you came back with lots of experiences that you described to me. Does food and travel function like that for you as well?
Yes. You know, when I first met David, who's a very, you know, he's very cultured and learned and all of this, and I think he was very horrified when I came to visit him in London, and I really wanted to go to the supermarkets and the markets, and he wanted to go to Stonehenge and Bath and
V&A.
V&A, exactly. And I think there was a point very seriously where he thought, oh gosh, I don't know how we could be together. And then one day...
A cultureless Malaysian.
See, I'm painting him out to be very, very bad, but we're still happily married, I'm happy to say. But I think the penny dropped for him that I actually understand and access a culture and a people through their food. And I think he thought that perhaps I wasn't so shallow after all once he sort of got that about me.
Yeah.
So yes, when I visit a place, I do try to get in through the food. For example, in Tuscany, you know, sort of understanding, you know, about how they don't put salt in their bread.
Yes, I know. My dad is so loves this like bland bread.
Yeah, well, I couldn't get it. And then now I still don't quite understand. But there's something for me about that made Tuscany very different. You know, just that no one else likes bread without salt, but they adhere very much to
I love that bread now. I really couldn't stand it. Years of, from traveling and coming, there is something about that you layer it with a flavor, with a prosciutto, and I just.
Why don't they have salt?
Maybe I'm showing my ignorance because I don't really know, but all I know is that for me, when you kind of put it together nicely in a beautiful sandwich, that blandness that kind of coats the things that are, salty and fermented or cheesy, it's just so good.
So
I really
do you think
that
it functions more like a carrier?
This is my idea. I know it's probably worth nothing, but I know that I grew up with my grandparents' house, they're from Italy. They always used to have a tube of anchovies, an anchovy paste in a tube.
Oh, I love that. Gentleman's relish, isn't it called gentleman's relish?
Yes. It wasn't called that there. So they used to have these anchovy paste, tube paste delivered from Italy. And a very kind of bland bread with butter and that really super salty anchovy paste for me is like such a it's just the flavor of childhood.
I get it. Where else can you buy salt-free bread?
I don't think you can. No. You need to make it yourself.
Yes.
Well, there's an idea for you. No, something simple.
One less ingredient,
On this note, should I go and get some tea?
Oh, I'd love
tea. I've got rooibos
tea
for you.
That's very nice. Thank you. And something yummy and sweet.
Something, a sweet delight.
Sweet delight, yes.
I brought something which would be very familiar to you.
I love them.
Salt caramel brittle. Mm.
You had
from Ottolenghi.
You had me at salt caramel.
So it's just, I'm sorry, it's the sound of cellophane.
Yeah.
It's the best sound.
Is it?
I love it. It means you're opening something delicious.
That's true.
Essentially it's a layer of like a thin savory cracker, lavash cracker, and a layer of caramel, chocolate on top.
It's
caramelized
so great.
Hazelnuts and
salt. I wish
salt.
I'd come up with that. It's
I know,
so
you
great.
Didn't develop that
no,
recipe.
No, I didn't. But you know what I've done? I've made a with matzah. Yeah, Passover friendly. I have to get my, with matzah.
Get your holidays right.
Get my holidays right, yeah. So, if you don't want to make your own lavash.
So you did it with matzah, and it was probably amazing.
It was great.
It was
just
the same.
Like this. Well, yes, except that matzah goes soft very quickly. Do you find that?
If I ate more matzah, I would have probably go. It's like water crackers.
That could have made it into your simple. The
matzah salted
yes,
caramel.
Yes, because it's very easy.
So tea and a bit of chocolate caramel brittle.
Yeah.
That is a good way to
end
a sweet way to end a meal.
Yeah. Tell me about I haven't even had a good look. I know it looks amazing. I love the cover and I love the name. And I'm slightly jealous that you're having this baby so soon after sweet. But but what's simple in dessert? What simple
desserts,
are cakes
okay.
in there?
So essentially there, I mean, with cakes, they will always take time to bake. So you can't, put a cake in the oven and have it take it out after 12 minutes.
But the oven's doing the work. You're not doing
but
any
the
work.
Exactly. So I think it is about the oven doing the work. Mm-hmm. It's something which is you can just quickly knock together. And I think a simple sponge, like we spoke about, getting it right is half the work. So there's a couple of cakes that are got really beautiful texture. There's a hazelnut peach and raspberry cake. Do you remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
It's got a slight crust almost on top from the brown sugar.
I don't know that one.
I think you've
hazelnut,
had it.
Hazelnut, peach, and raspberry.
And raspberry cake. Mm. That one is beautiful. And then there's a spiced apple cake. So a few cakes.
Mm-hmm. That looks gorgeous. What's that?
That's a set cheesecake with honey, yogurt.
Yeah, they're easy, aren't they?
Thyme.
You don't even need the oven for that.
You don't need the oven. You need to let it set. But this one I noticed sets quite quickly. So I managed to make it and serve it within a few hours.
Oh, I like that. Can I have the recipe?
Yeah, you can have the book.
Yes, please.
I might give you a copy of the book if you're nice to me.
If I'm good.
Yeah. If you come out good on the podcast, I'll give you that.
Oh, dear.
And my favorite dessert here, I made it when you and David came there, vanilla custard with roasted strawberries and rhubarb. Remember that?
I don't remember.
When you and David came over, there was this custardy thing.
But you gave us the dregs from some because we didn't get the whole dish of that. We got No, we got a little leftover tiny bit that we had to share.
Because you came late. You were like, you came for tea and I had a cake. And that was the dessert from lunchtime. Right?
That's right. You'd had a Mother's Day thing.
Yeah, and then it
which
rained.
Which they were served the proper thing, and then we...
And then it rained and the cake got soaked. Yes. It was an apple cake.
And it's the first time we could sing that song, you know. Someone left the cake out in the rain.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm going to make it.
It literally happened.
Because it took so long to bake it, except that it didn't take so long to bake it.
Because it's in Otolenghi.
You know we're showing our age singing MacArthur's Park. Donna Summer.
You're singing it. I'm not. I'm just like humming along. But more seriously, so things that are dessert-wise, things that are made in advance, like a really, really simple custard, or there's a labneh there, which is literally just yogurt that has lost. Yeah, sweet labneh.
So I've only ever had them as savory.
Well, what is labneh? Essentially, it's drained yogurt. So you could do savory or sweet with it. So it's got roasted strawberries.
Gorgeous.
And it's just, you know, it's like, the thing is, you take the flavor by reducing something, you get this intensity of flavor. So you do that to the yogurt by turning it into labneh, and you do it to the strawberries by roasting them. So you have this kind of really too intense flavor, yogurty flavor and strawberry flavor.
That's our style, isn't it? Intense times two.
It tastes that too. You know, what did we say when we were traveling in Malaysia? We said extra joy.
Extra joy. That's right. We like to infuse everything with extra joy. You know, does it spark joy? Was who's that lady, that Japanese lady who wrote that book, The Magic?
Oh, of tidying up.
And you know, her motto is, if it doesn't spark joy, then throw it out, right?
If it doesn't spark joy, throw it out.
Well, the question for her is how to decide whether you need to get rid of something. The question you ask is, does it spark joy? No,
I love the Japanese equivalent to the word my aunt used to say, if you haven't worn it for 2 years, for God's sake, throw it out.
Nothing like a Jewish aunt to get it just spot on. I love it. But anyway, I think for our product development, we could do that. You know, the question to ask is...
Does it spark joy?
Does it... Yes, or what was it we used to say? Extra joy.
Extra joy.
Does it spark extra joy? Does it spark joy? No, it's out.
Good point. Fabulous. Thank you, Helen.
Thank you for all this delicious and simple food.
It was a pleasure.